What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. It's been a rough week for the Philadelphia 76ers, knocked out of the playoffs by the Hawks. Ben Simmons won't shoot in fourth quarters. Breakup between Simmons and the Sixers might be coming. They got a lot of work to do. Overseeing all of that, at least from the business side, is my guest today. He is Scott O'Neill, the CEO of the 76ers. And Scott is much more than a business guy. He's a huge basketball fan, lives the game, breathes it, been around it a long time. He's been around the NBA a long time, worked at the league office where he worked for David Stern, was at Madison Square Garden for a time running the Knicks. And Scott's got stories to tell. He's also the author of a really fascinating new book. It's called Be Where Your Feet Are, 7 Principles to Keep You Present, Grounded, and Thriving. And look, I'll be honest, and I've known Scott a long time, so I was more open-minded about this book than I would be by someone else, but I don't usually read self-help books. I'm a little cynical, kind of comes with the job. It's not the first book I would normally pick up, but I did because it was Scott. And you know, he's seen a lot personally and professionally, a lot of life lessons that he's picked up along the way. And I think there's just a lot of really valuable lessons in this book. I actually really enjoyed it, got a lot out of it, as well as out of our conversation for the podcast. I think you will enjoy it as well. Before we get to that, a brief reminder, please subscribe, rate, and review the Crossover on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and tell your friends. And if you have any feedback or questions, of course, you can always hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Sixers CEO Scott O'Neill is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to welcome the CEO of the Philadelphia 76ers, among other titles, Scott O'Neill. Scott, how are you, my friend?
Howard, better not deserve.
No, you deserve a lot. I have no doubt about that. We've known each other a long time. I know how hard you work. And unfortunately, we are making this connection. We set this up weeks ago when I thought, cool, I'll talk to Scott right in the middle of the conference finals. We'll talk about this glorious run the Sixers are on. This is running later this week, but we are speaking the morning after. It's been like 12 hours. How would you describe your state of mind? I know how competitive you are. I know how emotionally invested in this team you are, even from the business side, maybe more so. How are you processing, to use a word, where things are right now?
Yeah, you know, I typically give myself to noon on days like this. So I believe it's 11 a.m. So you're about an hour away from joyous Scott again. You know, I've been thinking, I couldn't sleep at all last night. You know, I have this expression I used during the playoffs, which I'm sure you experienced as well. I call it tired and wired. So you're just wired from the games, whether it's your own or some, you know, watching the Jazz or the Suns, not Jazz anymore, the Clips, or the Bucks, that incredible Bucks Nets series. I feel like I haven't slept in a couple months, and because I'm just tired all the time and wired all the time. And then with your particular games at home, there's so much that goes into putting on a party for 20,000 of your friends every night, you know? So, so I can tell you that, you know, upon reflection, which is the best I can do right now, you know, I think about what I walked into 8 years ago, and I walked into a team that had just traded for, you know, the Andrew Bynum experiment was over. We had two first round picks in the next 5 years. Sam Hinkie was a wet behind the ears general manager who had just traded Drew Holiday, who's still a heck of a player, for the rights to draft Nerlens Noel. And we eventually got Michael Carter Williams with the next pick. And we were practicing at PCOM, which is a medical college. There was just one court. You've been to plenty of practice facilities around the world. And this was probably the worst in history. It reminded me a lot of my junior high school gym. There were 4 baskets, believe it or not, and 1 court, and we shared it with med students, future doctors. And the locker room had 12 lockers in it. We had 15 players on the roster, obviously. So some of the guys just put their stuff in the corner on the floor. Our workout room was the size of my bathroom. And I remember I walked in there my first day for the press conference, announcing me the CEO, and looking around, and the only thing that was going through my head as I was trying to mask it was, this is not a world-class organization. It's just not. On the business side, we were last in every metric. You know, I think our, just to put things in perspective, I think our season ticket revenue was something like $14 million. And right now it's like $80 million. Just to give you a sense of, like, you know, the difference between here and there. I think we were 28th, 29th, or 30th in every metric, from season tickets to attendance to sponsorship revenue, ratings, brand metric, brand affinity. Any way you measure our KPIs, our key performance indicators, we were last. So this was clearly a turnaround, like so much so my dad called me and said, like, son, even you can't fall off of this floor. It was like that. And so if you go back to 8 years ago, and you fast forward to last night, you know, we have a world-class training center. I say the best in the world, but maybe it's top three in the world. We have two global iconic superstars. We have Doc Rivers, who through this pandemic has proven to be an extraordinary leader on the court as he's off. Daryl Morey joins Elton Brand. We're solid. And the basketball team finished first in the East, and we had a disappointing finish, and on the business side, holy moly. I mean, this is the place to be. It's the team to follow. When I got to Philadelphia, they told me we were 5 of 5, meaning behind the Philadelphia Union and the Flyers and the Phillies and the Eagles in terms of affinity. And you'd make a strong case that we're number one, very least number two behind the Eagles in the market. You know, we're the fourth most followed team in China. We bought the Devils Prudential Center, created an innovation lab, built a real estate company, built a sports marketing company called Elevate. We raised a venture fund. I mean, this is like, we got into esports. I mean, this is now almost a $3 billion venture. We've grown the business, you know, the value of this organization over 6 times in 8 years. So when I step back, when I give myself the luxury of, trusting the process, if you will, that's where I am. I'm in a better place. When I focus on the moment, or, you know, 2 years ago, the Mother's Day massacre in Toronto, or this Father's Day fiasco last night, it's hard, man. It is. When you put your blood, sweat, and tears into this, just to be fully transparent, it's hard. And I hurt for the players. I hurt for their families. I hurt for this staff. Look, I'm old. I've seen this. I've seen this movie before. You know, I've been in this business 25 years. Won some big games, lost some big games. And you either love this. You know, I give you a story. My daughter, she's interning for the Jazz, okay? She goes to school out there interning. And she called me after they lost, bursting into tears for 20 minutes. And so I let her carry on and give me her sob story. And I said, honey, look, here's the deal, Lex. You either love this, and this is what you love. Like, you love that. Like, I'm not saying you love the pain, but you love the emotion. You love the ride. You love the wins. You love the losses. You, like, feel. Like, you just feel. And we're very, like, we feel in our family. Like, we're emotional. It's my Italian blood, I think, that weighs in. My wife, steady as a steady Eddie. Me, I'm up and down. My daughter, Lex, my older one, up and down. And you either feel that and love it, or you turn and you run and you never look back. And I was like, you got to make a call. You got to make the call. And I hope she stays in the business, because there is nothing like this business. We have purpose. Like, if COVID has taught us anything, it's we have purpose. Like, we are our why is so clear to me. It's like, we bring people together. We unite people. We unite cities. We give you escapism. We give you love. We give you happiness. We give you fear and despair. We give you emotion and escapism, but we bring connection at a time when we need connection more than anything else in the world. So a long answer to a really short question is, when I think about today, I'm very proud. Like, not a pat yourself on the back, but like if you can be humbly proud, that's how I feel. I feel like this has been a heck of a journey. It's been 8 years. And boy, if you'd have told me in, what was it, 14, 15 or 15, 16, whatever that 10-win season was, that we'd be sitting here at number one in the East after, you know, you could shoot a cannon in that, no stands and not hit anybody, and now you can't get a ticket. This team, I mean, we have the biggest season ticket base in the league next year. Like, it's crazy. So if you'd have told me then, now, if you'd have told me, like, I couldn't go to, I told my kids not to go to a game for that. Like, you can't come. Like, why? I'm like, because I don't want you to hear what they're screaming at me. That's why. Wow. You know, and so that, you know, I was like, you know, you want to check out some good, go to Google Reddit, Scott O'Neill, and then you see, like, what that was like. Because I don't think people really understand, like, what that was. I know what that was. Like, I was through it. I went through the mud. And I got to tell you, I love where this organization is. I love the people here. I love, this is a family. We take care of each other. We treat each other well. We work really hard. We have, like, really, really big eyes and really big goals. And we talk about growth and business, and it's fun. And it's, but it's, man, it's a tough day today, for sure.
So, I mean, obviously, I appreciate the long view here. I'm a reporter. It's my whole point of my profession is professional emotional distance. I can sit here and go, you know, I can tell somebody, yeah, you know what? You know, I know you're disappointed, but the Sixers, think about where you were. Exactly what you just presented, Scott. The trajectory and the path that this franchise has been on, the evolution. And that's all great, and those are all positive things. And Philly fans 8 years ago, 7 years ago, whatever, would have, like, killed for that outcome. Guess what, guys? Here's where you're going to be in 2021.
That's right.
But of course, none of that matters today, because it's just the sting of defeat. And not just that, but this team had legitimate championship hopes, and the roster, the coach, the front office, everything is in place that you look at it and the outline of a championship is there, and you're falling a couple rounds short now. So when you have to be in the moment of it, and I know for yourself and for your own sanity, you need to take the long view. But those same fans you alluded to on Reddit and everywhere else, what are you telling them at a moment like now? Or is there even anything you can tell fans at a moment like this?
Time heals all wounds. I mean, I just, again, you know, you've been in this business. I mean, I think I met you in, what, 2003? Something. I've known you for a long time.
It might have been a little later in the 2000s, but somewhere in there, yeah.
I will say, like, you know, you when you're running an organization, you hope you have a team that can compete. And I tell you, 2 years ago, that J.J. Redick, Jimmy Butler team, that team could have won a championship. I said that to Doc Rivers, went to dinner with Daryl, Doc, me, and Elton when they first came to town. And I knew Daryl, of course, known him for 20 years. And Doc, I didn't know. I mean, we knew all the same people. We had a lot of same friends. And my friends were calling him, and his friends were calling him, you know, and all that stuff. And I was like, you know, he's like, man, we were talking about team, life, business, family, all that stuff. And I said something like, you know, it's four bounces away from a championship. And he's like, you sound like a fan. And I was like, bro, I've been in this business a long time too, my man. And I know you're Doc Rivers, but I got to tell you, like, you don't have many chances to compete for a championship. There are 29 other teams in this league that are fighting every day to do exactly what we're doing. And when you are good enough and the path is laid out for you and you have the talent and you have the infrastructure and you have this coach and et cetera in place, like we did in Toronto with that team and like we had against Atlanta with this team, they sting a little bit more. You know, and it doesn't mean, like, when I was with the Knicks and we haven't made the playoffs in years and years and years and we go up to Boston and lose that series, I got to tell you, it felt like I got punched in the face, okay? Like, it and they were better. You know, but I still, it was just like, we're working so hard to get a team there, you know? But it's hard. Yeah, I'm not like, you know, I'm human. You know, I have emotion. I hurt. And I hurt for people and I hurt for this organization. I hurt how sad everyone is and how mad everyone is. But for fans, you know, these are the most passionate fans in the world down here. I mean, this is, you know, and, you know, it's my friend sent me a note today about the six stages of grief or whatever it was, or, you know, I just deleted it instantly. And I'm like, I mean, I got plenty of things to grieve, but it's in one of them, you know. Yeah. I mean, this is a game, and we fought our butts off, and unfortunately came up short. By the way, how about Atlanta? Good for them. Good for Nate McMillan.
Amazing.
You know, good for Steve Koonin, who runs that business, and Tony Ressler, like, you know, new guy in the league. I know him and his bunch of his partners are wonderful people. We had great, you know, it's just like the NBA, it's a unique league. You fight to the death on the court, off the court with partners. Like, we spent a lot of time with them in Atlanta, and they spent a lot of time with us, and we were treated like royalty down there, and hopefully they would say the same thing up here. But good people, they put on a heck of a show up there, and it looks like they got something going.
Yeah, no, the Hawks are incredible. None of us could have seen it. There's a lot about this season that we could not have seen coming, including, by the way, in the other conference, the Suns being in the conference finals. But the Hawks are an incredible story. So, but at a moment like this will be my last question just about this Sixer season that just concluded. What is the why do I have to keep coming back to the same process word? Like it just sneaks into conversation. What is the process for an organization or for your organization at a moment like this about dealing with the pain and the disappointment of it, figuring out what's next? There's obviously a lot of changes already been made, right? Doc just finished his first season with you guys. Daryl Morey just finished his first season. You have these two young cornerstones. We don't need to get into the roster decisions that come, but what is the process at the ownership and management level of saying, okay, how do we learn from what just happened, channel whatever that disappointment and pain is right now productively? How long do you take before you make any decisions as an organization?
Yo, that's such a loaded question. You already know the answers. Like, this league is a 12-month league. You know, you don't have the luxury of time. You know, we've got drafts right around the corner, free agencies right around the corner. I mean, I guess what was different this year, you know, I mean, Doc's seen this movie, Daryl's seen this movie, Elle's been around the block. Like, this is a world-class front office. Like, I don't know how long you take to lick your wounds. I told you I was giving myself till noon. I don't know if I'm Daryl or Doc, maybe it takes a week. I have no idea. I don't know. I've never worked with those guys the first time. And it's been a strange year. It's like, you know, we don't really even know each other that well in terms of work context. It's like everyone I've ever worked with, we're just, you know, in and around each other all the time. And this, we're us all separated. So I can't pretend to know like how they handle disappointment. We all have our own method to do it, but we don't have time to cry in our Wheaties right now. It's like reboot, retool, let's go. You know, like, what do we learn? What do we have to do? And they'll do it. And Daryl's, you know, look at his history. You know, he's been a deal maker his whole career. So I'll be very exciting to see what he decides to do with this team. I'm sure in consultation, of course, with Elton and Doc. And but man, it's gonna be fun. It won't be dull. Never is dull. That's the one thing you can count on in Philadelphia.
Your franchise is not dull. No,
it ain't ever dull. there's always something cooking.
And I've always told people too, anytime anybody had a question about the Rockets when Daryl was there and now about the Sixers now, my default answer on all questions about the Rockets then, the Sixers now, is Daryl's going to be aggressive. There's going to be, I don't know what's happening next. I guarantee you they will do something. Your book, which you have two of over your shoulder, not just one, Be Where Your Feet Are, 7 Principles to Keep You Present, Grounded, and Thriving. Which principle applies today?
Trust the process. That definitely trust the process.
Still.
Have a plan. And by the way, this applies to life, and applies to teams, applies to business, applies to you, applies to the relationship with my wife, applies to the relationship with my children as I'm trying to raise 3 strong women. And it's like, you know, we live in the Insta famous world, right? We live in the TikTok famous world. It's not 15 minutes of fame anymore, it's 15 seconds. And what we see on Facebook and Instagram is cute. And I love to learn about your daughter and her scoring the winning goal. Good for you. Or, you know, my friend's son got into Yale, my daughter didn't. You know, God bless America. I think all that stuff is great. And everybody should keep posting it. It's fine. Like, I love to see cool stuff about my friends and their kids getting married and school and successes. And it's just not life. Life is messy. Life is running a company into the ground. Life's getting fired. Life is having trouble at home. Life's having a daughter who's suffering from anxiety. Life is, you know, a daughter crashing a car. Life's a miscarriage. Life, that's what life is. You know, and by the way, all that stuff happened to me and all that stuff's in the book. And this is not a book where I'm like taking a victory lap. It's not me like saying, hey, look at me, I'm awesome. Hey, look, everything is awesome. It's not that. This book is about like the reality of peeling back that onion and looking at somebody from the outside who has it all figured out. Because that's what it is. I got my fancy suits on. I'm like sitting in great seats at games. I've run multiple sports organizations. I've got, you know, live in a beautiful neighborhood. I got this amazing wife for 25 years. But guess what? How about getting your face kicked in repeatedly? And what you learn when you get your face kicked in, or at least sand kicked in your face, is that there are all these amazing lessons to learn. And that's where the joy is. That's where the people you meet. That's where families form. That's how you get strength and grow. And that's how you learn. That's why trusting the process is so important. It's like, you know, the fake veneer. If you can peek behind the curtain, you see everybody has that crap in their life and it's messy and it's okay. And I want everyone to know that it is okay. And that you can get through it. And not only can you get through it, but you're going to learn and grow. And that mountain you're climbing, I got to tell you, like, it's the wrong analogy. It's the climb up the mountain. It's not the top of the mountain that we want to get to.
No, and I think it's important to point out, and I'm glad you did as you were going through kind of all of these things, these challenges that people face in life, that these were your challenges, that this book is not, as you say, a victory lap. This is whatever success people see in Scott O'Neill, CEO of the Sixers, and Harris Blitzer. You've been through some stuff professionally and personally, and you're very open about it, very raw in this book. And I think like that's, you know, the lessons are obviously grounded in your own experience. And it's been obviously pretty tough. So I want to emphasize that, because I think people, if they look at it as a book, it's like, oh, this is just, you know, one of those motivational books, or some CEO is going to try to tell me how to live my life. Like, no, folks, Scott's been through some shit. Okay. He's seen a lot. Yes, I can curse on this podcast, Scott. Sorry. I apologize. But anyway, and I think there's a lot of great stuff in there. And so, like, I think this is not just for people who are MBAs or CEOs, teacher, musician, writer, whatever. I do think there are great just kind of life lessons in here. For everyone, do you think some of these, because you are writing this from the perspective of a business person, are there some that you think are the most universal that you find that your friends who are in other walks of life relate to the most?
Yeah. I mean, what I've heard from, it's like when you write a book, it's pretty humbling. I mean, and especially if you put it out there, you know, this is raw and humbling. And so the first thing, you know, you try to avoid is like the mom thing. Cause my mom thinks I'm amazing. I promise you. She's probably the person who wrote my bio for that they sent you before this call. So it's like, you know, and I love my mom and she loves this book and she thinks I'm a genius, but I've gotten notes from strangers, which has been really pretty amazing. I mean, so, you know, I just got one literally this morning when I woke up and he just said, like, I listened to your audio book. I was driving from wherever to Idaho or something. And he said, I cried for the first 5 hours. And I was like, all right. And then it was like, I'm going to be a better father. I'm going to be a better husband. And that makes it worth it. I will say, like, that is the stuff that matters. So is there some, be where your feet are. Put your freaking phone down and get your head up. And in the office, yes, I have a phone table. And you come into a conference room with me and you're going to put your phone on the table. And we're going to sit around before the meeting starts. And I'm going to ask you how your weekend was. Because I think that's a lost art. It, you know, kind of the world has become an elevator. Everybody like just stares down. And I think, and at home, we have a phone basket. It's not in here, it's outside. Anyway, we have a phone basket. So like you don't walk up to the dinner table with your phone. And I will tell you, like, it's hard. You come home from a hard day. I don't care if you're selling insurance or painting paintings or you're a writer or you do what I do. It's like you come home. Some days are hard, man. It's grind and you're stressed. And we've got to be dads or moms, and we got to be partners, and we've got to be friends, and we've got to, we've got to be better and do better. So I think what's resonating for a lot of people is I had this, one story in the intro about my daughter. Well, there's another one in the back about another one of my daughters, which is write a love letter to each other. Okay. So that's one that's resonating with a lot of people. They said, look, I cried writing yours. And I said, it's not about crying, reading mine. It's about writing yours. It's like, how many real conversations are you having with your children? Like authentic, not, hey, how was school? Fine. What'd you learn? Nothing. How you doing? Good. And then she goes up to her room and I'm like, I'm done with that. Like, I want us to do better. My wife said to me once, would you do this at home? I mean, would you do this at work? And I was like, no. She's like, well, lead. And I was like, good one. You know? And I think like, some of the stuff we use at work to be extraordinary at work or to be successful at work or just to get by at work, like that's some stuff we got to bring home. And I think, you know, I the most embarrassing thing is like during the pandemic, I bought like thought starter cards, which is so embarrassing. Cause like, I'm a good conversationalist. Like I like people, you can drop me in North Korea and I'd like be having conversations, you know? And I'm sitting at my dinner table cause I hadn't been to family dinner in 25 years. I'm at family dinner every night for 14 months. And I bought these little cards and it was just like, you know, what's your favorite vacation and why? You know, if you could meet anyone who they like, and by the way, I mean, after a week, I'm like, okay, I got it. ask interesting questions and let's talk. And we got into some real stuff. I mean, there's some pretty heavy stuff. I've got three daughters who are all very different. They're all very strong personality, and they all see the world differently. And what a difficult time for this country, but what a wonderful time in the House to start talking about things like social justice and talking about things like politics and talking about things like, what does it mean to be a working mom? Like, what does that look like? Or what does it mean to be, challenging yourself? Like, what are you going to accomplish this summer? Like, I'm just not sure we're having those conversations. So if you take one thing out of this, it's be where your feet are. Put your phone down, get your head up, engage. Engage in the moment. Make moments count. If we learned another thing in this pandemic, it's fleeting, man. Time is our most precious commodity. It really is. And we have this incredible opportunity that's sitting right before us. And yet I'm out with my friends 3 days ago who I haven't seen in a year. And I walk up, of course, I'm the latest one there. They all got their phones out. I was like, guys, we're better than this. I haven't seen you in a year. What are we looking at? You might have to. You're like, hey, maybe there's news on this. It's playoffs. These guys, me, I'm not missing anything on Twitter. Nothing. Nothing they can't wait. There's no text I have to answer. There's no TikTok video I need to see. And I wonder if we commit to each other, really say like, if, and I said to these guys, wasn't well received. I said, like, if you don't want to be here, you shouldn't be here. But if we're going to be here, let's spend the time together. And I wonder if we could live a little bit stronger, if we can make a little bit of an impact. And the last thing, I know I'm talking way too much.
No. Keep going. It's great stuff.
Is like, I do this thing. I've been speaking to companies. I spoke to Google, AstraZeneca, all these big time companies. And I always start the same way. I was like, all right, pick your phones up. And what they think I'm going to say is put your phone down, turn it off. I say, no, pick your phone up. I want you to text your mom. I want you to tell her that you take 60 seconds, tell her you love her, what you appreciate about her, and one thing you learned from her. They go to do a thing. Here's what my mom said to me the first time I did this. Okay, this was like 4 months ago. She's like, hun, are you okay? I was like, shh, I'm better than this too. It's like, and moms are the most underappreciated class of people in the history of humankind. However, it's like, what if we just did that 60 seconds a day? 60 seconds, not just your mom, but you should send one to your mom or your dad and your dad. But like, what if like mentor, teacher, coaches, friends, neighbors, colleagues, people we worked for, people we work with, people that work for us. What if we sent one text a day just to check in and tell someone we love them and we appreciate it? The world's better. Like, these are simple, simple things that the world needs right now.
It's great stuff. It resonates with me way too much, unfortunately, because of it's all the things that I feel like on a day-to-day basis I personally am more often than not failing to do. And I admit, every so often somebody will do that text check-in with me, and I think, why are they checking in today? What's wrong? Are they okay? Why are they? Because we don't do this enough, when somebody does take the moment to just send the out-of-the-blue text, that's literally nothing behind it, no agenda, no anything. And then why are they reaching out right now? Is there something... It's a strange sensation because you realize it is. It's because we are not we're not engaged enough, and we're not reaching out enough, and we're not, you know. So suddenly the thing that should be the obvious human thing to do becomes the anomaly almost.
Right. And your intention. Once your intention is, I'm going to do this every day, you are. I promise you, the world will send you people in your head, and you're like, yes, I should send her a text. Yeah. Yep, I got sent.
No,
and I feel good when someone reaches out to me just to check in. People need stuff from you all the time, Howard. They do. Okay. People need stuff from me all the time. You know, I oftentimes get like, hey, just checking in on you. And the next thing is, hey, can I have tickets? So like, I get that bracketed a lot. It's okay. It's part of the job. I understand. But like, what if we just purely were checking in because we cared?
Yeah.
You know, I think we need to do that more.
It's an important reminder for all of us, and I will admit this freely, me especially. We've been through this crazy, it's stressful year for everybody on a number of levels. In the midst of the pandemic, we also had this exploding social justice movement. You'd note in the book a couple of things. There's the personal side of it where you talk about your own self-education on these issues and realizing at a certain moment where I need to know more about this. I need to have a better sense of this. And I think, you know, we both come at this from a similar standpoint, probably as just middle-aged white dudes who, you know, did not experience a lot of what we were hearing others have experienced in this country, in this world. And this is, you work in a league, and I cover a league that is 75 to 80% African-American players, and their experiences, which we heard a lot more about over the last year, we weren't in tune with before. So we've all, I feel like there was a moment last year. We all felt a little bit better about getting an understanding, engaging, adding our voices when we can. But here we are, Scott, a year later, and I feel like a lot of this has already kind of faded. So I a couple thoughts on this, and just take this wherever you want to go with it.
Sure.
You know, the league did what it needed to do in the moment, I think. And I think not for political or business purposes. I think the league embraced Black Lives Matter because it was essential. This is who the league is. So Black Lives Matter was on the court. The slogans were on the jerseys. A lot of social justice messaging, everything else. We get to a new season. No one's kneeling. No messages on the court. And so it's easy to think, I know there's some financial commitments that were made too, but it's easy to think, well, the league moved on. And so I'm curious about that part of it. But also within that, you do note in the book that you had season ticket holders who don't agree with this, who said, I'm out. And you had to say, that's fine, move on without us. You're a businessman. That cannot be a tough or an easy conversation.
I'll go back to the core question in a second. But I will say, like, even during the process here, every time someone said, this is crap basketball, my money back, I'd be like, no problem. As long as you promise not to come back for 3 years, you can have your money back for the whole season. I'll rebate even the games you came to. It's hard. This one's hard for me because I have a hard time believing that values like equality is something you can take the other side of. That's really hard for me. Like, I don't understand. Okay. And I do talk about in the book about like how much I thought I knew versus how much I know. And it was, the gap was too wide for me to get comfortable. Okay. And if it's too wide for me to get comfortable, I imagine that's representative, that I'm on the positive side of the scale in terms of knowledge. And I thought my gap was huge. And, I didn't really understand systematic racism. I didn't even know what the Tulsa massacre was. I mean, it's I had a lot to learn and I learned it. And I got great education from my colleagues at work. And that was a gift that I'll never be able to adequately repay. But has the league quit? And heck no, man. We are, I don't know. I wish everyone knew what actually happens behind the scenes. I mean, I'll just talk our organization. I'll talk bigger, 20,000 foot. I mean, we have this incredible program called Buy Black, where we support five black owned early stage businesses in Philadelphia and in Newark. And it's cool. We give them free sponsorship and we give them resources, et cetera, and access to branding and marketing and PR, and et cetera. And it makes me happy. And I hope we make a real difference in these 10 businesses. We're gonna do 10 a year. We did an audit of our vendor spend, and it was painfully white. And so we set benchmarks, and we're in the process of diversifying who we spend money with. We invest in a business in a housing project in Strawberry Mansion, an area of Philadelphia that's in need of some resources. We bid on a $4 billion project at the waterfront that was going to put $1 billion into the African-American community in Philadelphia. And so we are putting our money where our mouth is, and we are making a difference. And look, am I going to change the world? I mean, the organization, not me personally. I think so. I do. I think we all have to do our part. I mean, I walked into an organization that was 95% white men. Can you imagine that? Like in this day and age, an NBA team. We had one woman who was a VP or above, one, okay? And we had one director who was a person of color, one. And now 34% of our organization are people of color. And you might say like, yeah, but you grew your organization. I was like, yeah, 61% of the people I have hired since I've been here in 8 years are not white men, okay? So it's not an accident. Like you don't drive diversity accidentally. And so my friends who call me and say, hey, should I hire a chief diversity officer? I'm like, you're the chief diversity officer. You're the CEO. That's your job. Like, now, I have a chief diversity officer, so I'm not disparaging that mark. His name is David Gould, and he knows more in his pinky than I'll ever know, okay? But like, it's you. It's on you. it's on you to say, no, you can't hire a white man for this job. And you know what? That sucks to hear for a lot of people and they don't like it. But you know what? We got to do better. Now I've got 18 women who are VPs now, 13 SVPs and above, including our COO, our chief revenue officer, our chief people officer, our GM of our building. Like, I mean, it's cool. Like it's, and I wish, you know, not wish. I hope that people understand that I believe that it's a competitive advantage. I'm not into charity. I'm a businessman. Okay. I like deals. I like business. I like good business. And I have in my soul, I believe that if we have diverse people around a table, we're better, smarter, faster, and make better decisions. I believe in my soul. And so I drive it. And so my friends are like, you know, I've got to like diversify my organization. I'm like, I'll see you in 5 years. I'll see you in 3 years. If everything goes well, like it's not by hiring someone. That's not creating a diverse organization, nor is it inclusive. You know, the first few diverse hires you hire, it's hard for them. Women, people of color, African-American, whoever. It's like, you know, it takes time to build a community where it becomes part of who you are and part of your DNA. It's fortunately part of ours now. And by the way, I'm not like, we haven't won the race. I'm just saying it's like, we are fighting the fight every day. And we're making sure that this is a place where diversity is celebrated in the community and in this office. And I'm sure like we stumbled and failed. I'm sure we hired the wrong person or fired the wrong person or said the wrong thing or did the wrong thing. Sure. Sign me up for all that. I got you. But this is a process I'm proud of. So does that in the NBA, man, I will tell you, like, we don't have a conference call. We don't have a Zoom call that this is not put at the forefront. I mean, we get literally executive candidates sent to us every week by Oris, who runs the diversity program, the NBA. The commissioner like rails. They're showing stats and facts. Like here, we're going through stats and facts of our organizations as to our diversity numbers and how we're doing and who we're hiring and why. Like it's for real, man. And so I don't know. I think that the branding stuff is good. It's positive. I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we got out there. But it's time for the real work, like the real work. And that happens inside organizations where we can be role models and we can hire, we can change. And it happens in the communities where we can actually make change the world. And our players, I love. I mean, you know the players in the 90s, you know the quotes that the most famous players have said. It's a different world. I'm proud. I love it. And I don't always agree with what our guys say. It makes me even more proud. Like this is not a group that's fighting a political fight. They're fighting a social fight. They want to make the world better. And that's not just like Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris. And by the way, they do it and good for them. It's like my daughter is 14. It's like, Dad, this isn't right. I'm like, that's right, hon. That's right. What are you going to do about it? You know, and I love that. And she's in Savannah, Georgia, building houses right now in some crappy area, living in a bunk room with 10 other girls. I'm like, good for you. You know, because you can talk about it all you want, you know, but we got to move to action. So no, I hear you. Like, are there business implications? I'm sure there are. I don't care. I hope nobody cares. And the people who care, the people who want to change the world, they'll be with us. Because I'd hate to be on the wrong side of history. And this is the right side of history.
Amen to that. It did come with some consequences, or at least perceived consequences. And of course, as soon as the ratings, you know, go a certain direction, you immediately have people trying to, use that as a hammer to smash the league with and say, oh, look, this is what happens. You know, they're embracing social justice. And so people are tuning out or whatever. Like, what do we know or not know? The league obviously has a lot better metrics than those of us in the media or fans do about whether there's any nexus between what the league does off the court and how it might impact ratings, popularity, all this stuff. So people will spin it every direction. They will use their, because they have their own political agendas. Does the league have a sense of whether there has actually been any negative consequences to being so out in front on social justice issues?
I would have to ask them. I mean, I don't know. I would just say, you know, this, like the ratings argument is, it's interesting and compelling. Like, we have the greatest content in the world. It's consumed differently than it was 10, 20 years ago. The media rights holders can't get enough of this property. Only 1% of our fans will ever see a game live. So we're spending a lot of time on second screen, third screen experience. It's a global business. I mean, I don't know. I'm really bullish about the league and where it's heading. And maybe there's some blowback. I would just say, like, the world isn't full of white men. It's just not, you know? So I think we're heading in the right direction. It's the most global league in the world with the biggest stars on the planet who are people of color. I mean, what better commercial could you have for the world and social change? I mean, I go back to, like, you know, the old David Stern stories of him, like, you know, like what he did with HIV and Magic Johnson. It's like, I mean, you go back to, I don't know. I just think that's what this league is. And so is it for everybody? I think so. I mean, everybody's invited, you know, no one is cut out of this league. You can love us, you know, and we will have you. But do people want to make other choices? If they do, enjoy. We'll welcome you back when you get the bug again. Like, I can't go without watching games, and it's like a, you know, I never did drugs. So this, I guess, is my version of drug.
All right, last one then, because you mentioned David Stern, and this was absolutely on my list, of course. You mentioned him at one point in the book where you describe his management style. This is like the nicest description of David Stern's management style. You allude to, quote, fear and intimidation are effective motivators, and episodic micromanagement drives extraordinary management. You left out all the F-bombs that are mixed in there.
Yeah.
But it worked for David on some level. You know, you worked for him, for people who don't know, you worked at the league office for a long time too. So, and you've worked with him obviously from the team standpoint too. You know how David operated, and that was a very kind description, but accurate. Either that or just your best David Stern story.
I mean, there's so many. First of all, I love him. God rest his soul. He handed me my career. I mean, I'm not doing what I'm doing without David Stern. I was not president of Madison Square Garden without David Stern. I'm not the CEO of the 76ers without David Stern. No chance, no how, no way. I tell you how when I interviewed, I have so many stories.
Well, even the ones that are in the book, like, he's hard on you. Like, he is he's hard on everybody.
So here's one that's not in the book. Ski Austin was a longtime events guy at the NBA. And Ski famously told me when I left on my last day at the NBA, when I was heading over to MSG, he says, "Scott, the first day I met you, I knew I would hate you." Ski Austin. Okay. So we were in Orlando. He didn't. He became a really dear friend of mine. And we were in Orlando, and we were running a league meeting, or whatever, 1,000 team people there. And it's my meeting, so I'm putting the meeting on, and David is the talent. So he would come in and, you know, address everybody. So it's the night before we're having a cocktail reception. And we forgot the name tags at the hotel. And it was at the NBA restaurant, whatever it's called, down there in Orlando. And that was a big thing, because David didn't want to be embarrassed, because he wanted to know everybody, because he wanted to be able to talk specifically to each person about their teams. He was very interested in people and their businesses. And so Ski and I were standing there, and someone had tipped him off on the plane. There are moles everywhere. So he comes in with a head of steam, and it's me and Ski, and he is screaming this close to my face, you know, "You mother ever, what the hell you doing?" You know, and I'm just standing there. Somehow, I don't know if it was like playing for crazy coaches when I was growing up, but I got a calm when he'd be screaming at me. I really got a calm. And I looked over at Ski, and he always liked to divide and conquer. That was the thing. So he would like try to put me against Ski and Ski against me. And I was just, he's like, who's responsible? Is this Ski? Is he incompetent? And I was like, No, it's both of us. I mean, it's my event, and I'm responsible, and Ski's responsible. And together, we're going to figure this out. And of course, there's people three levels down from us, and whatever. And he is screaming. Then he goes to Ski, and Ski's like, what he said, no, sexually. And then I said, "Hey, David, like, we can either sit here and scream at me for another 20 minutes while everybody looks on." I said, "Or I can stand by you. I know everybody in this room. I'll just tell you who they are." And he's like, "Shut your," you know. Anyway, but that was the type of environment. By the way, that bonded me and Steve forever. But I have a lot of those moments with him. I remember, this is the worst one. We were in, swear, I know you said one, but.
No, go for it.
I was one of my first trips with him, and I didn't understand him at that point. I was a young guy. I was probably 32 years old. And you get a chance at 32 years old to travel with who I consider to be like the father of modern sports marketing, right? The greatest of all time. We get on the plane, everybody shoots for the back because he is a tyrant. And I would always sit right across from him. And because I was always fascinated by him, you know, I just wanted to learn. I figured like I could learn anything. And he would get on his phone, you know, on the plane, he'd have a stack of papers and magazine articles. He was reading about science and technology and geopolitical, you know, business too and sports, but you know, everything else. And then whoever was sitting near him, he would just be grilling, you know, and putting him on the hot seat. So we get to, and I would taunt him a bit. It's fair enough. So like he was always on a diet. His wife traveled with us sometimes and she'd be like, David, I'm hungry. You know, can you get me something? And I was like, David, I'm hungry too. Can you get me something? He would just glare back. Or when he was on a diet, I would get a cookie and the press would be facing him and I would be behind him and I would be holding up a cookie. So I did stuff like that, which I probably shouldn't have done. Anyway, we're sitting down and we hadn't slept in a couple of days. He would get up at 5 a.m. and I'd be in his room. I was advanced. So, you know, when you're an advanced guy, you do all like, you know, you have to know where to go, what to say. You have the message points. You're doing like, it's kind of like an executive assistant. That wasn't my role, but on these trips, that's the job I played, a role I played. And it was a particularly difficult trip. He had walking pneumonia at the time. And this guy, I mean, he was just a warrior. So we sit down. He's like, do you have the name? He's like, why don't you relax? Why don't you put your feet up? You want me to get you something to eat? I was like, what are you talking about? Like, we're done. Like, we had literally 10 meetings in 10 hours. Okay. And this guy is just, he gets up, no notes, hits every message point. I'm like, here are the notes. He looks at me. He's like, I don't need these notes. Gets up, hits every message point. Like, it was kind of insane. Like, I'd never seen, he must have a photograph of me. Unbelievable. And so we finally sit down. I'm exhausted. I've been up since 5. It's now halftime or whatever, second period or second quarter. He's like, why don't you put your feet up? You relax. You're all comfortable. You want to get you something to eat? I was like, nah, I'm good. I'm fine. He's like, what's my pilot's number? I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm like scrambling through my notes. I'm going through my briefcase, like texting all his assistants. And I get it in like literally 60 seconds. I was like, it's a 201. He goes, I have it. Why don't you have it? You're the low man on a totem pole. You need to have this. I was like, yeah, kidding, man. Right. I was like, fine. Okay. You prove your point. He's like, oh, do you think the Utah media would like to see me at halftime or are you just going to sit in and get some more popcorn for yourself? I was like, so I was like, no, I bet they would. So I walked down, you know, we got my little pass on. You know, walking down, I go to see the producer of the TV. I'm like, hey, would you take David? He's like, oh, I would love the commissioner. You're kidding me? I'm like, okay. I was like, when do you want him down here? Bring him down at this point, blah, blah. I was like, okay. I walk over, radio, same thing. They take him. I walk up. I'm like, straight, you're right. Utah will take you. He's like, what about Portland? I'm like, like that was him. And that, I mean, it was never enough. But I will tell you, like, my attention to detail is my attention to detail because of him. Like my team I work with now, they understand like what world-class looks like. They understand what executing an event looks like. They understand like we don't make those mistakes because if you have that stuff, because the world is swirling and things are going to happen and problems are going to happen and you do everywhere, every time, but you take care of your business, then you can handle that stuff without a problem. But I mean, I got off the phone one time. Phone rings. He's like, you mother ever, and I was like, mom, like, you know who this is. You know exactly. So I have so many of those stories, like, you know, where, but I will tell you that I don't think many people understand because a lot of people saw that side of him, especially internally. It was a hard place to work. That 8300 number would crawl across your phone, and you know that heart was beating fast. But I had some challenges, some medical stuff with my family, and you know, I mean, he was the first call to me. I didn't call him. He's like, hey, I understand you have a problem. I was like, how do you, wait, what? He's like, here are 5 doctors. Linda's going to walk you down the numbers. We'll set up appointments for you, blah, blah, blah. Calls me 3 days later. He's like, hey, I understand you don't have an appointment. I said, no, they're waiting. He's like, wait. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. He's like, okay, you have an appointment. It's at Columbia Presbyterian, blah, blah, blah. Like he was that guy. And then would follow up a week later. It's like, do you need anything for your family? Like this guy would, you know, he was tough, okay? But he was your tough. He was like a tough dad. Like, I needed anything at any time from anyone, he was there without me asking ever. Like, he was that. He was a wonderful soul, but man, he was tough as nails. Tough as nails.
That sums him up perfectly, I think. He was one of a kind. We do miss him. Scott, I think I've held you longer here than, and we're also coming up on noon. So like the clock is ticking on when you get to
three minutes away
from everything just being perfectly fine.
That Lego guy.
Everything is awesome. Appreciate it. The book, folks, again, Be Where Your Feet Are. Go check it out. A lot of great lessons in there. Trust me, for all of us. Good stuff. Appreciate it. Scott, thank you for spending the time. Thanks for the great thoughts and some great life lessons there, too. Appreciate you.
I was always rooting for you. Take care and thank you.
Okay, that's all for today's show. Thanks again to my guest, Scott O'Neill. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the NBA chatter. And on Fridays, it's me and a guest. We've got some great ones lined up. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter @HowardBeck.